Hello and welcome to lecture two. Just to give you a picture of what I'm going to spend my time on today, I'll just go over the solution to this famous trine state measurement problem and discuss it a little bit. And then Aggie asked me to give an outline of the topics of the other lectures after my lecture, just to give you a sense of what other people will be lecturing on, although, yeah. And then I'll talk about reversible computation, just some principles that everybody should know. And then I'll talk about something related to quantum cryptography, the BB84 key distribution, which maybe Michele won't cover. I'll spend a bit of time on it, and then I'll talk about communication complexity. And then I have some other stuff. If you want more punishment, then I can talk about the GHZ paradox or something, or Bell inequalities. Okay, so remember this trine measurement problem. This was a little bit fun. It was a slightly tricky question. That's why I thought it would be interesting. And somebody did have a solution. I can't remember the actual expression, but the success probability was 0.62, roughly.
I think it's 2 plus square root of 3 divided by 6.
And would you like to just give an explanation as to what the strategy is? Yeah.
So my strategy is choose an answer and then
okay, go ahead. With my trick, I don't have to lecture.
So my strategy is by symmetry, I just choose the vector from now this is 30 degree.
Mm-hmm.
Now my strategy is choose a vector from here, call it A.
So it's half of 30 degrees there?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So if I get a result, if I get a result, then I will say it's come from this. Get a negative result, I get nothing, then I will say this vector.
Okay.
So the total probability of correctness is 3 times sine square plus 1/3 cos.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the maximize this.
Okay. Okay. That's nice. And maybe another way to summarize it is you just assume it was just one of these two vectors, and then the best strategy is to pick an set of two orthonormal states such that the angles are the same. And that somehow gives you the best success probability in a case where it's one of these two. And in the case where it's this one, well, you just kind of lose in that case. So you lose a third of the time, but you're only slightly worse than two-thirds. And I think that's the best you can do if you perform a unitary operator, a one-qubit unitary operator, and then a measurement. A projective measurement, but you can still do better. And a hint I was kind of given by this comment that I made about Holovo's theorem, that when you're measuring a state, you could perform a unitary transformation and then measure in the computational basis, but you might embed into a larger space, and you can potentially have more power by doing this kind of measurement. Did you want to say something, or?
Yeah, you can just use POVM. With
yeah.
Three guys being projector on that thing, projector on that thing, projector on that guy.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the easy solution if you know this pretty good measurement. That's called the pretty good measurement. That basically what it does So there's this very systematic way. I was going to mention that at the end, that if you have any number of states and you want to distinguish between them, like you just have any set of vectors going in all sorts of directions, you have 17 of them, and you want to distinguish, you're given one of them and you want to distinguish which one, then you can associate a POVM element with each of them in some systematic way. And often it does very well. It doesn't always give you the optimal, but in this case it will. So that is a valid solution too, and that will give you 2/3. Did you work that one out? Okay, but if one does. But if we didn't know about this that approach, then there's another way to think about it. So we have these three states, and so we add an extra qubit in state 0, so now we're in a 2-qubit system. And in the 2-qubit system, the states are, it's just one of these three states in the first qubit, and then the second qubit is ket 0. Okay, so now we have three vectors in a 4-dimensional space, and they're coplanar. They lie in a 2-dimensional subspace of the 4-dimensional space. So there's some kind of nice geometry here. So now you can do a rotation. So although it's a 4-dimensional space, we're going to just do everything in a 3-dimensional subspace where we only use the ket 0, 0, 0, 1, and 1, 0. As the, and we forget about the ket 1, 1 because the ket 1, 1 never arises here. So we work in this 3-dimensional subspace. And then what we can do is, and I think this picture kind of says it. You can rotate the plane. Is that kind of visible? So these kind of, these kind of blue-green vectors, they're supposed to be visually in the same, lying in some plane. They're coplanar. And then you take the three orthogonal states, the basis states. So this is kind of like a corner. There's a 90-degree angle between every pair. And you orient them so that it's symmetric, so that each of these basis states just lies on top of one of these. So if you look down from the very top, you would just see this sort of, these vectors that are 120 degrees apart. If you were looking down from the top, and you would see the coordinate axes just kind of lying off at some angle. And if you did that, then the sine of the angle between these two is 1 over root 3. So the cos of the angle is root 2/3. So then if you perform a measurement with respect to this basis, then the probability of this collapsing to this is the projection probability. So it's the square of root 2/3, so it's 2/3. So it's kind of the same spirit of just taking your, in two dimensions, taking the orthonormal basis and just kind of orienting in this sort of nice way. So you split the difference, but in three dimensions, and that will do it. Okay? And I was going to, this is your comment, that you could also do this, and there's another solution by just constructing these POVM elements. Okay, any questions about that? So here's a list of topics after this lecture. So there'll be quantum algorithms and no-go results. I think Michele is doing that part. So maybe he'll say something about Shor's factoring algorithm or algorithms related to that, or about the spirit of that. And there are other algorithms. For example, if you want to search in some sense for some special item that has some special property among n items, then you can, the number of items you need to check scales as the square root of n instead of scaling as n. So you get basically a quadratic speed up over the best generic classical approach. And it may not seem that impressive, you know, it's only quadratic, it's not exponential improvement, but it's for an enormous number of computational problems where you can get an advantage by doing this. And then I think Debbie Leung will talk about entropy and data compression. And what is data compression? Well, if you have some data that's not uniformly generated, but it's, let's say, English text, you know, where E occurs more frequently, usually, you know, than the letter X, then you can compress. And there's this measure that says how much you can compress according to the nature of the probability distribution of the data. And there are these compression algorithms for classical information. And it's interesting that you can also compress quantum information. And there's a notion of quantum entropy. And that's what Debbie will talk about. And then Daniel Gottesman will talk about... Oh, sorry. Debbie's probably also going to talk about noise models and channels.
I'm not sure.
Or Daniel? Well, one of those two. Somebody is going to talk about error-correcting codes. And what is an error-correcting code? That's not where you want to compress information, but where you have some kind of transmission system which is not perfect. So it's a channel a quantum channel, and which is not the identity. So it changes the state, and it may destroy information and create errors. And if you want to have a better, if these errors are problematic, what you could do is you could invest in building a better physical system that's less error prone, and then you would have more reliable transmission of data. But what you could do also is use software to have a noisy transmission system and express the transform the quantum state into some code word in some quantum error correcting code. And this is done also with classical information quite frequently. And then you can reduce the effect of the noise. So if you have inexpensive hardware and you have a lot of it, then you can actually, you don't necessarily need to make it more reliable. You can just use these clever codes to get better fidelity in your information. And it's for transmitting information, but also for storing information. If your medium doesn't, the information decays, error-correcting codes can be useful for this. And it's quite remarkable that quantum error-correcting codes even exist because they're all based on some sort of redundancy. And what is redundancy? Well, you think one kind of redundancy is having multiple copies of the state. And if you have multiple copies of the state, it's redundant because if you lose some copies, then you can still recover things. But remember, in quantum information, you can't produce multiple copies of quantum states. You can't clone. So there's a big difference between multiple copies and just having redundancy. And you can have redundancy is weaker than having multiple copies. So now, this what I've been talking about so far is a scenario where you're able to manipulate information perfectly, and then you put it through some noisy medium for communication or for storage. But what happens if the gates that you perform on the qubits in order to generate the code words are also subject to noise? I mean, it seems like a much harder scenario that while you're generating the code words, noise is being is occurring, and then, well, if you haven't thought about that before, it might seem like that's a hopeless scenario, but in fact, there's a way of doing this doing things fault tolerantly, where you can use principles of error correcting codes to actually compute with noisy gates, So there, if you think of one of those circuit diagrams that I, you know, had displayed yesterday, imagine all those gates are not doing exactly what they're supposed to, but they're, you know, it's some quantum channel that deviates a little bit from the actual unitary operation that the gates are performing. At each time step in each qubit position, there's some kind of an error. You can, if that's your scenario, you can still do quantum computing, because you can take an original quantum circuit that computes something that assumes there are no errors, and you can construct it, you can turn it into a fault-tolerant quantum circuit, which is bigger, which has this kind of redundancy property that it's resilient against some noise in the gates. And it will give you the answer with high probability. And you might say, oh, but how much bigger? And turns out it doesn't have to be much bigger. If your circuit for doing whatever problem you wanted to solve is of size, you know, n to the c, you know, polynomial of degree c, then you just pick up some logarithmic factor in n. So it doesn't have to be much larger. Of course, there are multiplicative constants matter, right? Things like that. Okay, so after that, Michele is going to talk about security, and I think one of the topics is going to be quantum safe encryption, which is basically a lot of existing crypto systems will become insecure once we have quantum computers, and let's change those right now to other encryption schemes that are not, whose security doesn't depend on things like the presumed hardness of factoring, and then our secrets are safe. And even there may be a secret now that's so important that you don't want somebody to be able to decrypt it, not just now, like my credit card, but maybe 30 years from now you don't want somebody to be able to decrypt it. Now, my credit card probably doesn't matter 30 years from now, it'll probably be a different card, but there may be some state secrets or things like that that you really don't want anybody to ever be able to decrypt even with better technology. But there's this other contribution of quantum information to cryptography, which is this whole different way of encoding messages, and this is like an encoding scheme that's not for compression, it's not for for resilience against noise, but it's to hide information from eavesdroppers. And there's a whole different approach to doing that, using the properties of quantum states. And there are actually existing systems that you can buy that use this. This is actually not as hard to implement as a full-blown quantum computer. And well, there are other kinds of cryptographic protocols for things, for identifying yourself what's a good example? Quantum money, good example, yeah. So, where just the quantum state counts as the bill, so as a banknote. Thank you. And okay. So let's imagine that we just had classical money. And basically that you don't have to give me, I don't have to give you a bill from my wallet, I just give you a binary string, and that's my bill. And maybe it's 100 or 1,000 bit string, and I give you that, and then you can go to a store and, you know, give that big string, and they can, the clerk in the store can run it through their system and check that, yeah, that's the same bill, and they can deduct it from some account in this master bank. You can imagine something like that, but it would work if there was one centralized bank that would keep track of all these banknotes that have these serial numbers, and as soon as it's spent, it would sort of mark it off as spent, because if it's just a binary string, you can produce a copy, and you can spend it, and she can spend it at the same time. And then what happens, you know, I guess it's a race as to which message goes to the central bank first. And then the second message says, sorry, that banknote has already been spent. But suppose you want to imagine you want to have a system that's like that, but where there doesn't have to be a centralized bank, where in each store the clerk can use some machine that just depends on localized information. It wouldn't work. Because you could spend the money, but you could make a copy and someone else could spend the money, and there's no way that, you know, someone, the clerk in Australia, would know that the clerk in Toronto, you know, that they're, you know, unless they communicate with each other. But with quantum information, you can have this feature where it's basically not a binary string, but a sequence of qubits is the banknote, and it has the property that all the desirable properties of money. Including anonymity, by the way, where it's not like my credit card, where you know, they know I spent the money. You know, it's just something nice about cash that there's no record, but that you can't forge. So I give you the banknote now, which is qubits, but now you can't make a copy for her because that would be cloning.
How do you measure whether I gave you the right one? Because then you have to, like...
Oh, well, it's quite subtle.
Yeah.
It's quite a big issue, and it won't work if the bank just stores the actual classical description of the quantum state. Although that was the original scheme that was proposed, 40 years ago.
Suppose it would, like, prepare them all and up and store their all up. Then, and I give you a bunch of qubits, how do you check whether, with 100% certainty, that they're exactly all up? You don't want there to only be 100 possible bills in the world, right?
That's right. There should be exponentially many valid states.
Yeah. So you need to be able to distinguish them.
That's right.
So I can't just, like, go around and take some random qubits and give them to you and pretend like it's fine.
That's right. Like there's this space of n is sufficiently large so that there are many different states, and only a small subset of them are valid banknotes. I mean, it's not obvious from what I said that this is actually doable. Maybe the way I explained it, gave the impression that I'm trying to say that it's trivial just by the no cloning principle. I mean, these protocols are they're quite sophisticated, the ones that actually work. So it's just a few years ago that they've been out. So the answer is that by doing things just in a naive way, it won't work. Okay, but I think it's too big a topic for me to get into, and I'd have to sort of look at those papers again that I haven't. I don't have fresh in my mind. So there's a paper by Aronson, and if you want to know more, quantum money. Aronson and I'm trying to remember the name of the, I'll just say et al. Sorry, I can't remember the second person right now, but you can. It should be easy to find by a Google search on that. I can't remember the name. Okay. Yes.
I think there was one Sci student who's working on quantum money now. Dax. Do you know Dax? Go.
No.
I think he's working with Aronson on quantum money.
What's the name? How do you spell it?
Dax. DAX.
D-A-X?
Yeah.
Dax
Go, K-O-H. That's his last name. Maybe not on this paper, but like...
Okay. So anyway, that gives you some references. Yes. Okay. Kevin Resch will talk about physical implementations and, in particular, quantum optics-based systems. And then the last, there'll be one lecture, I don't know the exact order, will be on relativistic quantum information, where we take into account relativistic effects. And I think there are some things that are invariant with that are frame independent, but there's other features that are not frame independent. It's actually not a subject that I know very much about, so maybe you'll see me here for that lecture. And then this is me. Okay, so that's an approximation of what's coming up. Any other questions or comments? Okay, so let me continue. So just some basics of reversible computing that this is not very hard, but maybe you should see this somewhere. Often one of the pieces that arises in a quantum algorithm, and you'll see, is some function that a classical function where the input is an n-bit string and the output is an m-bit string. And there's some way of computing that function, but it's just a function from n-bit strings to m-bit strings. And the way that enters into a quantum circuit is, well, there are two ways it can arise. One is, and this actually comes up quite a lot, it's a black box for F, where you don't actually see the function itself. The only way you can access it is by performing a query, by asking what's F at 0101, what's F at 1111, and so on. And so you have to ask questions to this black box that evaluates F, and you try to make as few queries as possible to answer the question. A simple example, which you'll probably see, is where you have a function that maps one bit to one bit. So there are four such functions. And two of them have the property that they're constant, like f of 0 equals 0, f of 1 equals 0. You know, that's the all 0 function, and there's the all 1 function. And then there are the other two cases where the value of f of 0 is different than the value of f of 1. Suppose that you have one of these functions, and you want to know whether it's constant or not constant. How many queries do you have to make to f to determine that? Like you have to see it in both places, because if you only see it in one place, you never know whether in the other place its value was the same or different. It turns out that if you're in the context of a quantum computation, you can solve this question with just one query, which is a little bit remarkable, but it's remarkable in the sense of super dense coding. It's a curiosity, but it doesn't look like you can. Like the justification for having setting up an institute for quantum computing, but it was a starting point. It was the first quantum algorithm. But now I want to say something about what it means, like to compute these functions. We want this to be reversible, and not all functions are reversible. So we don't want to have a quantum gate that does this. Like for that example, where the input is x and the output is f of x. Because if f of 0 equals 0 and f of 1 equals 0, then it's not a reversible, it's not a unitary operation. But you can always compute f in a different way, where you have two qubits, and one qubit is for the input, and then the input it's just echoed back, and then the other bit, this is still classical, is where the output goes, and the output you imagine this is initially in state 0, and then the value of f of x gets written here. And if the input is not in state 0, it's just in some arbitrary state y, then you can imagine the value of f of x gets exclusive ord onto this. if this is the way that you evaluate F, then it gives you exactly the same amount of power as this in terms of knowing the value of F. It doesn't make the constant versus balance problem any easier to do this with a classical computation, but now it's reversible. It corresponds to a unitary matrix. It's a permutation matrix, which is unitary. And we always want to, in quantum circuits, we want the gates to be unitary. So if you can, if you have a quantum circuit that's of that form, then you can embed it into a quantum computation and you can evaluate F in superposition. So why is this reversible? Because if you apply the gate twice, you get back to the original state. Now, there's also a notion of a white box computing F, which is where you imagine you're actually given the circuit that computes this. So you're actually given logic gates. So it's like here, you're not given the algorithm. You can't see the code. It's kind of in this box. And maybe if you try to open the box, it sort of explodes. But here, you can actually see the description of the algorithm. So if you study the algorithm, maybe you can learn something, some property of F without actually having to evaluate F. But whatever you can do with the black box, you can also do with the white box because you can just implement the black box, right? And usually what happens, and I think you'll see this in the quantum algorithm section of the course, you want to determine some global property of F. In this case, the property is a constant or balanced in that example. Balanced meaning it's zero in one place and one in the other place. Which doesn't necessarily pertain to the value of F in any particular place. Because you know, you can have F of zero be zero or F of zero be one, and it could, in both cases, it could be constant or balanced. And usually you have one of these functions that you set up, you compute, and then you want to determine some global property that's interesting. In Shor's factoring algorithm, something like this will come up where the function is periodic. And you want to know the periodicity, that's the property that you want. And it turns out that in the quantum context, you have to make fewer queries than if you only allowed classical access. And usually the way the algorithms work, I don't want to take the wind out of Michele's sails, but you can create a state like this. If you're given an implementation of a function, the white box, then you can create this state efficiently. And how do you do that? Well, you have a circuit for this, and if you just put instead of putting a computational basis state here, you set these to ket zeros, and then you perform Hadamard gates here. And then the input will be in a uniform superposition of all n-bit strings going in. Do you agree? And then the output state will look like this. It's when you're performing the Hadamard, just the Hadamard transform, you have this state, and then this is all, maybe this is all zeros, because you could just set these y's to all zeros. And then you apply this state, and by linearity, you get this. So you get a uniform superposition of x tensor f of x for all x's. And you've only had to evaluate the function once. And sometimes, so does this make sense that you can do this? No?
I have a question.
Yeah?
What is the situation where you don't know the F? Can you give us an example? I don't even understand what's going on right now. I mean, we have some inputs, and now we have some function, or some black box inputs, and we are getting an output.
Yeah.
So the situation here that we don't know what the black box is.
That's right. We don't know that.
Where does that happen? Can you give us
an example? Yeah. Well, it happens in a way. So these arose in the history of quantum algorithms as just some kind of some sort of intellectual game, and that's kind of not related to reality. But then it was discovered that if you want to factor integers, in order to solve the factoring problem, you can reduce that to something called the order finding problem. And the order finding problem is the following. Let me use the board. Is you're given a modulus M, and you're given an element, an A, some number A. And if you take all powers of A and M should be relatively prime. But I won't write that down. That's just a technical thing. No common factors. And imagine you write down the sequence, 1, which is A to the 0, of course, A squared, A cubed, etc. This will be periodic. You'll eventually get back to 1, and then A again, and then A squared, etc. Okay? And the order of A mod M is equal to the period of the sequence. Like maybe after when you take A to the 17, then you get back to 1. But the period could be really large, because if these are n-bit numbers, the period could be something that's exponentially large in n. So in order to find the period, if you just compute a squared, a cubed, and just keep computing them until you get back to 1, that will be not efficient at all. And the interesting thing about this problem is that this is equivalent to factoring. If you can solve this, then you can factor integers. So there's no efficient classical algorithm for solving this order finding problem. But what you can do is you can turn it into one of these oracles. These black boxes are sometimes called oracles. And what you do is you construct an oracle that for the function that takes f of x to a to the x mod m. So imagine you have this function, and you can compute this efficiently. Now, at first glance, you might say, well, maybe you can't compute this efficiently because x could be a really large number. Like suppose x is 2 to the n. How do you compute a? So there are two ways to compute a to the exponent 2 to the n. So there's the easy way and the hard way. The hard way is to multiply a by itself, and to do 2 to the n minus 1 multiplications. Okay, that'll work, but that's exponential. But there's a much more efficient way of doing this. And some of you maybe know it, because you've seen it. But don't worry too much if you don't, because Gauss didn't know about this, because he was multiplying polynomials, and there was a more efficient way, and he was kind of doing it this way instead of the fast way. So you want me to tell you the fast way of doing this? It's called the repeated squaring trick, where you take A and you do one multiplication, and you get A squared. And now you square A squared. And you do everything modulo M. And then you get A to the fourth. And then another multiplication where A to the fourth times A to the fourth is A to the eighth. If you do it that way, it only costs you n multiplications to do this. So using this repeated squaring trick, even if the exponent isn't a power of 2, you can still do this efficiently using the idea that I just mentioned. So you can actually evaluate this function efficiently, which means you can implement this with a polynomial number of gates. Yes?
Isn't a to the n mod m just like a number or something like that? No.
Oh, from Fermat's Little Theorem?
What?
I think this is
the x is the order function of the m.
If x is actually m, then yes. But x is not actually m. It's some number between 1 and m.
Okay, you were talking about a to the power, 2 to the power m.
Oh, well, I didn't say m is 2 to the n. So think of m and n and x as two separate numbers, and I'm just trying to give you the feeling as to how you compute a to the x with few multiplications. And rather than describe the most general case, I'll just describe the special case when x is a power of 2. And once you know this, it could be an exercise to say, what happens if x is just some n-bit string? How do you do that with a polynomial multiplication, number of multiplications? Okay, using this idea, once you have this idea, then it's not too hard to generalize to the case where it's not a power of 2. Okay?
So you can just factorize x to different power of 2.
That's right, yeah. Okay. Good. So what you can do to solve this order finding problem is you can create this. Now, I hope Michele doesn't get mad at me because of this, but I'll find a way to resolve that with him. You can evaluate this with a polynomial number of gates. I am still getting to your question. And then you can generate this state efficiently. And then you want to determine some global property of f. And in this context, you want to know the periodicity of f. And there's a way to look at this state and perform some gates on this state or measure in some special basis that you can actually determine the periodicity. You can determine, the r. And therefore, you can factor. So is that the answer to your question?
I'm so puzzled about the equation where we have a black box.
Well, okay, so you can imagine so if you have any algorithm that works with a black box and you make some number of queries, then if you can implement the black box efficiently, then you can run the same algorithm. So you don't really need the black box to do this.
Maybe it's the question, if you don't know what f is, how would you ever build such a black box?
Yeah, where does it come from?
Physically, do you ever make a black box?
It's kind of like a black box in the sense that if I actually write the algorithm in C++ that actually communicates, produces this, it's really hard to look at the code from that algorithm and figure out what R is. You can look at the code and you can probably figure out what A is and what M are, but you can't really, nobody knows how to do more than that. No, it didn't help, okay. So, so one way of dealing with this is to just forget I ever mentioned black boxes. And then is everything okay? If we just deal with this, that you implement this. Does it make sense? So I gave too much information.
Okay, so I think what I understood with you said just a moment ago was that sometimes you can write the code, which is classical, and you can't actually efficiently compute it, but then you can somehow improve into a white box,
yeah,
and then efficiently compute it. And that's where the black box is the classical code, and then you put it into...
Or sometimes if you want to determine some very interesting information about something, like for example the order of A modulo M, the way you can do that is to generate the implement the box for computing this function, and that's just a function whose truth table looks like this. And you can't efficiently determine the order from that because you'd have to look at exponentially many entries but then what you can do is you can do this trick which you'll hear about, that if you construct this state, you can construct this state if you can implement this, then there's some clever way of measuring it so that you learn this global property of F that you were interested in. In this case, it's the periodicity.
You can determine the period, not just the property of periodicity.
Yeah, you determine what R is. And so then if you're reasonably satisfied, I'll just tell you where the black boxes come in, or why they came in, because the history of quantum algorithms started with this this Deutsch algorithm, where people were just playing this kind of this esoteric game, where they just said, suppose you were playing this game, I mean, it's kind of like a 20 questions game, but you were allowed to ask quantum questions, like in superposition, or you were allowed to ask only classical questions. And they said, oh, for this constant versus non-constant problem, here's this neat thing, here's this problem where classically you'd have to ask two questions, and quantumly you only have to ask one. And then somebody said, oh, what can we get better than two versus one? And somebody came up with another function where you have to ask exponentially more questions classically than you have to do quantumly. And people just played with this, where they proved that you have to ask. They came up with all these kind of functions that looked really contrived, that had the property that you had to ask classically exponentially more questions than if you were allowed to ask quantum questions. And there was one particular example of that was very powerful, Simon's problem, that had that property. And then what happened is it was rejected from the top theoretical computer science conference because people thought, well, this is just some contrived problem, and you know, these are just black boxes, you know, what bearing does this have on anything? But Peter Shor was on the program committee, and he thought it was an interesting result. And he realized that the Simon problem is actually, if you abstract it, it's this periodicity problem, and that it actually solves the factoring problem. So it's kind of a situation where, for reasons that I won't get into, it's still useful to think about the black boxes, because they tell you what you can do. Thinking this way is sort of focusing on the problem when you only have this restricted access to the function f. So it's historically useful, and it also helps us develop the theory of algorithms. But maybe I don't want to say much more. Maybe I gave you a partial answer to your question. But you could feel free to ask more questions, and you don't look happy. you have a question? Feel free to. I mean, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah, thanks.
Maybe you are happy. Sorry. But you just had this look that it was something that wasn't satisfactory. So, but do ask questions. That's what I'm here for. I mean, I don't really have this agenda. I don't think I have to get to communication complexity. Okay. Now, I just want to say, once you get to this state, some people say, and people who really know better have often said this, and maybe when you're talking to the media or something, it sounds good, that you get the way quantum computing works is when you create a state like this, it's like you're evaluating this function in exponentially many places by just doing a single query. Because, you know, you have a superposition of all the values of f of x. And that's how you get the value. You only have to evaluate the function in one place, but because it's in superposition, it's like you evaluated it everywhere. So that's the savings. But that's not a valid way of looking at it, because once you have this state, what can you do? Well, if you measure the state, then the state will collapse to 1x and 1f of x, right? So if you were to just measure this, like in the computational basis, then it would be as if you just chose a random n-bit string x uniformly and then just computed f of x for that particular x. So you don't need a quantum computer to do that. It would just be a very roundabout way of randomly evaluating it. And in fact, there's no way you can learn the value of f in more than one place from a state like this. Yes?
Can you measure in some clever basis where the first basis element has that f of x for the first qubit has to be 0, in order to be projected on that state. And then the second one has to be in state zero and so on. So that when you measure, you see which one is in state zero. And then that one,
well, I got the first part, but you don't just measure this in the computational basis, but you measure this in some very clever basis. And by measuring in that clever basis, you don't learn the value of f in any particular place, but you learn that global property of f.
Yes.
And that's
what we're interested in is when f of x, we don't need to evaluate f of x for all x, we just want to find the particular x for which f of x takes a particular value, right?
I don't know. We don't even necessarily want to do that. So all we want to know is what, like, for example, the periodicity is. And the periodicity doesn't depend on the value of f in any particular place.
I mean, how are you going to measure the periodicity?
Well, there's a way to do that. I mean, you take, I guess I'm going to get into big trouble with Michele if I continue. But there is a way to do this measurement. And I'll just say that we've already seen something like it, because it looks like, think of these as the control qubits and this is the target qubit. And the control qubits, they don't change, right? But the target qubit changes. But that's only on the computational basis. And if you measure in a different basis, just like with that controlled knot gate, then the target qubit doesn't change, but the control qubit changes. And there's a way to do that where the control qubit gives you information about the periodicity. And I won't tell you how, because I want to leave something for the later part of the course. I mean, but that's it. So my main point here was that, just to set this framework, because I'm going to explain, this is just, I'm trying to explain why we want to actually do this. This is reversible computing. I'm just leading up to reversible computing here. I hope we get to it. And then my main point is that this is not how quantum algorithms work. They do construct states like this often, but this doesn't sort of have any magical property where you actually have all the values of f of x at the same time. Okay, although you may read that occasionally. Okay, shall I continue? All right. Okay. So it doesn't give all the 2 to the n values of f of x, but it's still a useful state if you measure in some clever basis. So it's really interesting, and I'd love to talk about more about this, but I'm leaving that for the algorithms. And okay, so how to simulate one of these black boxes? Well, for some reason in these notes, instead of giving you this function, I probably should have written this function, but I wrote this other function. And it doesn't really matter. I just mean any function that we can compute by a circuit. This is for the discrete log problem, not for the factoring problem, but it doesn't really matter what the function is. But just imagine we have a classical algorithm for computing f, and we want to now implement this in this reversible way. And I just want to mention some subtleties that come up. Because I did mention yesterday that we can always simulate any classical circuit by a quantum circuit, right? But there is this issue. And in that construction that I described yesterday, what you'll end up with, I mean, if you have the input x, and then the target is in state y, these are basis states, so think of these as n and m-bit strings. Then you XOR the bits of f of x onto the second register. But you also have these kind of garbage bits, because when you do a Toffoli gate, you get these two, you get three outputs, and then you remember you just throw away the other two, and one of them has the answer if you're simulating an AND gate. So if you just go through that construction, you're not actually mapping XY this, but you have this other register that's kind of coming along for the ride, and it starts in state zero and it ends up in just some other state that's in general not always going to be zero. Okay? Now, why isn't that good enough? If you're only going to look at basis states, then this would be fine, because you could just ignore these qubits, and you know, if you just look at the first two registers, exactly what you want is happening. But if you query in f in superposition, then this doesn't work. Can anybody say why?
Because you will create some entanglement between.
Yeah. You'd get this. And now this register will be entangled with this. And who said that? You? Oh. Oh, I did. Thank you. Yeah. So you can no longer discard. So this is a problem. And we want to clean up the garbage. So this is how not to do it. So you have to do a little bit more work to restore this back to zero. And it's not that hard, but you know, well, you should see it once. Here's how to do it. So again, this is what you want to simulate. You want to simulate the case where there's no garbage, because if this is always in state ked zero, then it will be in a product state. Then you can discard the qubits. And what you do is you use this additional register. So bear with me a little bit. It's not really hard. So this highlighted thing is just the additional register. So what's going on here? First, we're computing the function. So there's x0, and that becomes xf of x. But this third, I guess here it's the fourth register, contains the garbage. And so far, we have this second register y, and nothing's happened to register y. Okay? So we've just done this operation on the first, third, and fourth register. And the second register, we just didn't do anything with. Okay? Then what we do is we do a bunch of controlled NOT gates that, because in this register, we have f of x. And if we XOR each of these bits into these bits, then this register becomes y, x, bitwise XOR with f of x. So it's like we're copying the bits here. And then we do the reverse of this computation. This part is reversible because they're all reversible gates. And this reversible part, and now this register no longer is a participant. And now we're just doing basically this operation backwards. So we have f of x, g of x get mapped to x, 0, 0. So x, f of x, g of x gets mapped to f, 0, 0. And then we just throw these registers away, because originally we had all zeros with these registers, and now we have all zeros again. So that's how you do it. So you do the computation with the garbage, you kind of copy the answer somewhere, and it's not cloning because these are basis states, and then you undo the computation, and then you don't have the garbage. Okay? So there, that's it. It's not really mysterious, but it's, should see it once. And it's basically, since you've had to compute the function forward and backwards, it's basically doubles the cost in terms of gates. All right. How am I doing? So I've got 30 minutes. And shall I talk about quantum key distribution? Okay. All right. So there's this scenario here where we have Alice and Bob, and Alice wants to communicate and send a message to Bob, but we have Eve, the eavesdropper, who's listening in on the line. And how do they do this? Well, one way that's provably secure classically, but it has some downsides, which I'll explain. But it has this nice upside that it's very secure. It's called the one-time pad. And Alice has a string of random n random bits, and Bob has a copy of the same string, and they keep that secret. Okay, and I think in the you know, maybe in the during the middle of the Cold War, where there was the Washington Moscow hotline, they used the one-time pad, and. And they actually had somebody, you know, maybe with a briefcase handcuffed to his arm, you know, who would actually carry the bits to the other place. So no one, only Moscow and Washington would have a copy of these private keys. Because if the eavesdropper gets to see these, then that's the whole system fails. So they have to keep these very secret from each other. But assuming that from Eve. But assuming that they have that, then here's what they can do with the key. Alice has this arbitrary n-bit string. That's her message. And she bitwise computes the bitwise exclusive OR of each bit of each message bit with a key bit. So M1 gets exclusive OR'd with K1, M2, K2, and so on. And then she sends the ciphertexts, C, and another N bit string, over the line to Bob. And Bob, in order to decrypt the message, he also XORs with the bits of K. And then he'll get the message back, because if you XOR with a bit and then you XOR again with the same bit, you get back to the original message. So it has this nice property that Bob gets the message at the end. But we want something much more, which is that Eve gets nothing. Is there a way that we can see from this that Eve gets no information about the message? Even if she knew, he had some partial information. But let's just say, how do we know for sure Eve gets no information? Is there some simple argument about this? How many of you have seen the one-time pad before? Probably some of you have, right?
One, two.
Okay. Well, one argument is the following. If these are really uniform random bits, then the bits of C will be uniformly random, independent of the bits of M. So the probability distribution of the bits that Eve sees is completely independent of what Alice's message is. And therefore, there can't really deduce anything. It's just a uniform distribution. That's maybe a bit of a rough argument, but maybe it's some intuition. So this works great. But if they have an n-bit key, they can only use it to send n-bit messages. If they run out of key bits and they start recycling them, then it's a disaster. That's what I meant to say. Because if Alice encrypts two different messages using the same key, then Bob will know something, because if he knows the two ciphertexts, C and C prime, then he knows the bitwise XOR is the bitwise XOR of the two messages. So he knows some information about the two messages. And to be secure, by the way, we don't just want the situation to be that Eve can't know all the bits of the message, but she shouldn't be able to even determine partial information about the message. Like maybe the exclusive OR of all the bits of the message, or the 23rd bit of the message, because we don't necessarily know the context. And there may be a context in which learning this particular piece of partial information is very valuable to Eve. And in fact, historically, less developed countries than the US and the Soviet Union back in the Cold War again did use one-time pads, but where they recycled the key and they were broken, the systems. Okay? So the problem, of course, is how do you distribute the secret key bits? You don't want to send them over the channel, because then Eve will see them. And this idea of sending somebody on an airplane, with a handcuffed briefcase just sounds too clunky. But somehow you got to get them from Alice to Bob without anybody else seeing them. And maybe Alice and Bob have never met. So that's the key distribution problem. How do you set up these secret key bits? And often there are systems that are based on computational hardness, like the hardness of factoring or something like that. Maybe not. Factoring is not exactly used for this, but some other computational hardness. And just because I'm looking at the clock, it's not really the topic of this to discuss trapdoor one-way functions. So it's just the title of the slide is all I want to say. But there's a quantum key distribution protocol that uses properties of quantum information, which is what I actually want to talk about. And the scenario there is that Alice and Bob can send qubits to each other. So they have a quantum channel. But they also have a classical channel. But the classical channel, Eve can see. She can see every message. She can read all the messages. but we'll assume that it's authenticated, which abstractly means that Eve can't modify any of the messages because there are some authentication protocols that can sort of enforce against that. So let's just say it's a toy scenario where Eve can see everything on the authenticated classical channel, so it's no good for Alice to send an important secret bit to Bob on that classical communication channel. But you know that when Bob receives a message from Alice or vice versa, they know it's the correct message and that Eve hasn't sort of flipped the bit. She hasn't tampered with the messages. She's seen them, but she can't change them. And the quantum channel is one where it's like a fiber optic cable with photons going through it. You know, Eve can do whatever she wants. She can perform measurements. She can, replace the photons with other photons of her choosing. So Eve can modify the states of the quantum channel as much as she wants. She can measure and do whatever she wants. And then in this scenario, there's a key distribution protocol. And this BV84 Bennett and Brossard in 84. And it's easy to implement because you only have to send, it's sufficient to be able to send single photons. Now, when I say easy, I guess I should really put quotation marks around that because there are some subtleties and ways you can break things depending on how good the implementation is, you know, how faithful it is to the actual, to the theory here. But in principle, it's secure. But it's actually quite difficult to prove secure, and it was 10 years after that it was proven secure, and the first proof was so complicated that maybe 5 people in the world claimed they believed it to be correct. The author, I think Brossard was the PhD supervisor of the author, and but they accepted the PhD thesis not because they really believed for sure that the proof was correct, but because there were other results in the thesis that they thought were going to be strong enough. And then later on, there's this other scheme that has a much simpler, so that was Myers, the first security proof. And then there was a much simpler one that came in the year 2000. But notice that it was 16 years later that there was a simple security proof. So maybe I'll use probably all the remaining time to describe how BB84 works. Some of you must know this, right? BB84, how many of you? Anybody? Oh, okay, good. Right. So here are these states that we've seen. This is the computational ket 0, ket 1, and then here's the plus state, what I called the plus state last time, and then the minus state. And now we're calling them the BB84 states. And and the red states are basically encodings of 0, 1 in the computational basis, and the blue states are encodings of 0 and 1 in the Hadamard basis. And this is the way the scheme works. So I'm not going to give you that Myers proof, you know, that it's really complicated, or even the Shor-Preskill proof, but I'll give you maybe just the spirit of this. Maybe some intuition as to why we might think this could possibly be proven secure. So Alice chooses 2 random n-bit strings, A and B. And she sends this state, you know, where if the first index is the bit, sorry, this, yeah, the first index is the bit, and the second index is, it's 0, meaning it's encoded in the computational basis, and it's 1 if it's in the Hadamard basis. So it's like she basically chooses a random n-bit string and another random n-bit string that determines for each bit whether to send it in the computational basis or the Hadamard basis. So this is just a tensor product of zeros, ones, and pluses and minuses, randomly. And she sends that to Bob. Now Eve might see these qubits, and she can tamper with them. But notice she's not going to be able to measure in a way where she actually determines which of the 4 states they are, because they're not orthogonal to each other. So if she actually tries to measure to determine for each qubit exactly which state it was, that's going to tamper. That's going to destroy the state. So after receiving the message, Bob doesn't know which switch bases Alice has used. So Bob doesn't. I mean, initially Bob and Alice they have nothing, no information in common. So Eve has no idea what the states are, but neither does Bob. So what does Bob do? Well, he chooses a random basis in which to measure. Like, he kind of guesses the first qubit to measure in the computational basis and the second qubit to measure in the maybe in the Hadamard basis or something like that. She flips a coin for each qubit and just tries to guess. She'll get about half of them right. Did I say she? That's Bob. He'll get about half of them right. Okay, so far I'm just describing the protocol. So that's and when Bob guesses right, he gets the state, A equals A prime. The bit AI is that Bob gets from the measurement is the actual bit that Alice encrypted. And when Bob guesses the wrong basis, it's just going to be 50-50 chance. I mean, there's at least a 50% chance that the bit will just coincidentally be the right bit. So if Alice sends this state and Bob measures in the computational basis, it'll have a 50% chance of collapsing onto this or this. Okay? And then Bob informs Alice with a classical message that he's performed the measurements using the classical channel. Performed his And then Alice and Bob are kind of done with the quantum, the qubits. Eve might not be, but Alice and Bob are. And then Alice sends the string B, which reveals which basis she used for each measurement, for each qubit, over the public channel to Bob. But she's also telling Eve which basis she used. But notice that at this stage, Bob's already received the qubits. So it's sort of too late for Alice for the eavesdropper to decide which basis to do the measurement in, because, you know, the qubits have already gone through. You know, her chance to sort of tamper with them has gone, in a way. And once she sends this string, then Bob remembers in which basis he measured, so he actually knows in which cases he guessed the right basis. Okay, so these are the random bases that Bob chose, his guesses, and these are the actual bases, and then they discard the cases. Bob actually can say what bases he used, and then they both know in which cases they used the right basis, in which case the bases were inconsistent. And the cases where they're consistent, which will be about half of the cases, those are the qubits, those are the bits that they keep to produce the key. And so if Eve did not disturb the qubits, then the key could just be those remaining bits, because they would be consistent and they would be random. And Eve would have no information about them. But the interesting case is that Eve might actually have done some kind of measurement while it was sent. But the thing is, if Eve does some kind of measurement, then the bits of A and B won't be, the bits of A and A prime won't be exactly the same. And then Alice and Bob will be able to detect that. So they'll be able to detect that something funny is going on, that there's let's just say for now that there was some tampering. So the problem with Eve's situation is she wants to determine the bits by doing some measurement, but without actually revealing the fact that she's done some measurement. But when you measure, you disturb the state. Now notice that Eve can always just measure all the qubits or just replace them all with ket zero, and then the situation, Alice and Bob will know that there was tampering, but they won't be able to generate the key. And that's called the denial of service attack. And that's kind of like, you know, if it's a fiber optic cable, then, you know, Eve could always just cut the cable, and then Alice and Bob can't use the protocol. But so you can't really enforce against that. But at least if, you know, what it does enforce against is I'll say more about it, is a situation where Eve has acquired information about the key in a way that Alice and Bob are not able to detect the tampering. And so here's kind of what Eve could do. She was going to measure. She could just guess the basis, but she could do something a little more clever, which is to choose this basis that's sort of, you know, this is 45 degrees between these two purple vectors, and this is 22.5 degrees. And if she measured in this basis, then she'd have about an 85% chance of guessing each state correctly. And there would only be about a 15% chance that each qubit has been damaged. It measures differently at the end. Anyway, it can be proven, and I'm not going to prove it though, but I'm just saying it can be proven, that the more that there's some kind of an inequality, that the more information Eve acquires about the actual that string A, the more bit positions of A and A prime will be different. And what Alice and Bob can do is when they've got to the stage where Alice has sent the qubits to Bob, Bob guesses the basis in which to measure, he performs the measurements, and then Alice and Bob reveal their different bases to each other, so they know which bits to discard. Then the cases where the bases are the same, you know, there's a string A and A prime, and what they do is they want to know whether all the bits are the same of A and A prime. Now, one way to do it would be for Alice to send all the bits of A to Bob, and then Bob could check whether they're all the same. But remember, they want to use this as a key. So if Alice sends them to Bob, then Eve gets to see them. So he gets to see the key. So they want to do that in a way where they don't actually reveal any of the bits to Bob. And actually what they do is they take a random subset of the bits. If these are, you know, n over 2 bits, about half the bits, then they take, let's say, n over 4 random bit positions, and they check whether they're the same or not. And based on that, they can get an estimate of the percentage of bits that are different from each other. And those n over 4, which is half of the n over 2 bits comprising A and A prime, those are basically, they have to discard because they share those over the public channel. So Eve gets to see them, so they can't use those as a key. But if most of those bits are the same, then they can sort of statistically infer that the other n over 4 bits that they haven't shared are probably going to be the same too, and they can use those as the key.
So they pick those bits that they reveal, or do they pick them independently?
What they could do is, one of them could just choose a random subset and just send it over the public channel to say, you know, bit 1, bit 5, you know, bit 17, and so on. And it's okay if Eve sees that. So they actually share the addresses of those bits, and then they both know which bit positions. And then they know they're going to forfeit the secrecy of those bits. So, you know, Alice can just send all those bits to Bob, and he can just say, yeah, they were all the same, or 60% of them were the same, or something. So that's basically the idea. And in practice, there's going to be noise anyway because it might be a noisy channel. So there might be some noise that's not due to Eve. So really, there's some threshold that, it's based on properties of error-correcting codes, that if the error rate is below about 11%, then they're going to be able to produce good keys. If the error rate is around 11% or less, then that means for the bits that they're not forfeiting, they can assume some reasonable. I'm being very hand wavy here, but 11% of the bits are the same, and from that they can construct the key. But they don't want to actually use those bits for the key because only 89% of the bits are the same, and if they're not using the same key, the encryption won't work. So they actually have to tease out a key from those bits. And then there are two procedures, which I'll just mention what they are, but without going into detail. There's an information reconciliation, which is kind of like a distributed error correction, where they they produce a shorter key from the A and A prime, which are n over 4 bits each, such that, all the bits are the same, and such that during this correction, sort of this distributed error correction process, Eve doesn't acquire very much information about the bits. So maybe Eve has partial information about A and A prime. I mean, you can never prevent her from doing a very sort of soft measurement and getting a tiny bit of information that's hard to detect. But Eve doesn't know any more about A and A prime than she did before, but now the bits match. And then there's something else they can do, which is privacy amplification, which is now A and A prime are the same, and Eve has only a little bit of information, but she has some information about the key. And now they get an even shorter A and A prime that are still the same, but where Eve has even less information about the key. And these are classical protocols, because it's all classical information at this stage. So it's a little bit complicated to describe all this stuff in detail, but I just gave you an overview. I'll just mention that I think it was the year 1990, they actually decided to build a prototype, you know, IBM Research Center, a very toy one, where here was Alice and here was Bob in the lab. And just to show that this is not completely crazy, because back in those days, it did seem very far-fetched. And it did kind of work, but the system actually made a sound when the qubit was sent, and depending on which state was sent, it made a different sound. So you have to be careful about the physical implementation. That's the point. I mean, there's the theory and then there's the practice. And, you know, whether the practice, the implementation is really, and the theory are really faithful to each other. And there are ways, I mean, of generating these photons that I think is going to be mentioned later on by Kevin, that sometimes you can't really just send a single photon easily on demand. Maybe you send two copies. And if you send two copies, well, then Eve can measure one of them. And then so you have to be careful. And then there was another topic that I think I don't have time for. And unless people really want punishment, I can stay another hour, but I think this is a good time to end.
I think that was
going to
be...
Yeah, that was just a joke, yeah. Okay, so are there any questions or comments?
So you talk about the mentioned about the different curve. So different curve, to just easy to encrypt those messages, so what's the...
Oh, elliptic curves?
Yeah.
Oh, asking me to describe the system? I couldn't, off the top of my head. I think I knew it once. It's something like a discrete log, but it's over, if you have an elliptic curve, there's a group that you can generate related to properties of the, I don't know how much you know about elliptic curves, but there's this, this really surprising, or at least surprising to outsiders, group structure that comes up among the points. So you have these elliptic equations, and then you take all integer solutions, and there's this sort of funny way that there's a group structure. And when you have a group structure, then it makes sense to talk about a discrete logarithm, because you have a generator of the group, and then you can ask for an arbitrary element of the group G. What's the power that you have to set the generator to get that element? And that's the discrete log. Yeah, like this or something. Yeah, very roughly like this. It's more related actually to this discrete log problem, which all I said about that was this. This is the function that you would use for the discrete log problem. Why don't we end in the whole corridor? I can say more if you want. But okay, so thanks. It's been nice. Hope you enjoy the remaining lectures. Okay.